This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Fake the Nation, episode 251.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we gently coat the shrimp of democracy with an egg mix and a dusting of flour to create the tempura that is America. I am your host, Nikine Farsad, and last night I walked into my usual shawarma place in the 20 minutes before iftar, the Ramadan tradition of breaking your fast with a nice meal, and it was dead silent except for the cooks furiously putting out dates and other goodies because they knew that a horde of hungry Muslims. I almost said angry. They're not angry. They're hungry. We're going to bust open the doors any moment. And together we had a laugh because it felt like that scene in Vanilla Sky, except for like it was leading up to iftar and not whatever Vanilla Sky was about, which I don't remember. Anyway, Dean, have you done that where you've gone into a place like right before iftar and it's like deadly silent?
No, but I've been to places where there are Muslims who are hangry, where they're hungry and angry. Yeah. They've eaten all day and they want to eat and the clock. Worse in the summer when sunset is like, you know, 8 o'clock.
When it's like, yeah, today, this year, it's not so bad. Well, today, we're going to talk about how Democrats should talk and how they shouldn't talk. And we're also going to talk about violence in Hollywood. And finally, the YOLO economy. Is it a dumb term or a real thing? We'll figure that out. I am so excited by today's panel. Folks, I'm joined for the very first time on the show, but not for the first time in my life because I've seen her perform stand-up so astutely, so wonderfully, so beautifully. All over the city. And then she's also a writer of one of my, I don't know, I want to say all-time favorite television shows. All-time, yeah, I'll say that. It's an all-time favorite television show. And it's also one that I share with my mom, which I feel like there's not very many shows you get to share with your mom. You know what I mean? That it are also your all-time favorite. It's a rare Venn diagram crossover. Folks, it's the wonderful, oh, and that show is Marvelous Miss Maisel. I don't think I said the actual show. The show is Marvelous Miss Maisel. And the person who's on our show today is Allison Leiby. Hey, Allison.
Hi, so good to see you. This is so fun.
Oh my God, it's been so long. Years. It's really great to see you. Years. Weird. Why? We need to fix that. And also joining us, you've already heard me tease this guy. He is a comedian I've known for a very long time. I was actually telling the story of like the first ever time we worked together on your solo show at the New York Fringe Festival. It was like 2000 and let's not even say it. He is host of the SiriusXM show, the Dean Obidala show, and he's an all-around great guy and my friend. Folks, it's Dean Obidala. Hey, Dean.
Hey, you know, I was thinking the TV show I bond with my mom, she's Sicilian. It's like we're watching reruns of The Godfather and Goodfellas because my Sicilian mom, those are like, we watched it and she's convinced they're documentaries. And I'm always like, they're not really documentaries. Because she'll say like, your grandfather knew that guy. I'm like, I don't think my grandfather knew that guy.
Well, folks, before we get into whatever we're getting into, I just want to let everybody know that theoretically on June 8th, like as in a few weeks from now, I am going to perform live. It is Nikine Farsad presents a full hour of comedy from her mouth hole. And I will theoretically be doing that at Caveat. I say theoretically because we're still working out the COVID stuff because New York City just changed the laws like yesterday where you can have a full capacity theater, but you have to show proof of vaccine. So I'm trying to figure if you guys want to do that. In fact, please let me know if you live in New York City, if you live close by, would you come to a show on June 8th to see me? wherein they have you show your proof of vaccine, either with your little CDC card or with an app, like the New York State is using the Excelsior app. This is all stuff we've talked about on their show, weirdly. And so now I'm actually dealing with it, and it's like making me sweat. So let me know. I will be tweeting out whatever theoretical link it is to buy tickets. We're keeping ticket prices cheap so that you come out and experience and enjoy. You could wear your mask. Or I think not if you're drinking something or whatever. Again, like, they just changed the rules. I'll know more about all the rules. But Allison, would you guys go to a show if it involved you showing your vaccination status?
Yes.
Sure.
My, like, proof that I was my proof that I was vaccinated.
Yeah, like you as a human being.
Yeah.
Like if you were vaccinated and you could show your status. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think
that's
I would
why
too.
I did
I don't
it.
Know.
Like so that I could like participate in society again and society can be a thing
right.
again.
Right. No, that totally makes sense. Yeah.
Does seating depend on what vaccine you got? Like, I have Moderna. Does that get me closer to the stage?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Dean. We're not allowing Modernas in the room, so that's going to be...
That's the VVIP. Like, VIP Johnson.
I'm Moderna as well. I'm joking, obviously. Folks, let's get it. Oh, but before I get into it, again, I keep interrupting my own damn self, but I just want to let everybody know there's a new bonus episode of Fake the Nation that came out on Patreon. It's a conversation I had with Christian Finnegan and George Severus about a thing we read or saw or experienced that had a huge impact on our life choices, like a book or a movie or a conversation or a trip. And we got a little sentimental, and then we made fun of ourselves for getting sentimental. Give it a listen. And if you're not a member of our Patreon family, go to patreon.com/NagineFarsat to support the show and get those bonuses. For the cost of just one latte a month, you get free episodes of Fake the Nation. So it's a pretty good deal. All right, well, let's get into it with topic number one. Okay, so we're going to talk about the YOLO economy, which is a term I read in a couple of think pieces that is vaguely defined as taking that like you only live once notion, which when was YOLO like uttered every day? Was it like 4 years ago or something?
I
don't know.
4 or 5 years ago.
It was a dark period in our lives. And it's basically you only live once, and it's applying that idea to your post-pandemic career and financial choices. Apparently, a lot of youngins are quitting their jobs or they plan to do something unstable and more adventurous. So first off, Dean, have you like talked to anyone that's kind of taking a YOLO approach? Have you seen this in action?
I'm living the YOLO life. I mean, what are you talking about? My whole life has been YOLO. I used to be a lawyer and I quit to become a page in NBC to make $10 an hour. Then I worked at Saturday Night Live and I quit that to be a full-time comedian. And now I've taken the road less traveled. I mean, I really believe that. So for younger people who are wondering if they should take a chance, you should take a chance because maybe you'll end up on Nagin's podcast one day. I mean, dreams come true all the time.
Oh, the height of success.
But no, I really am an advocate of that you do only live once and that you have to make choices for yourself. And I'm happy I get a law degree, but I'm very happy I don't practice law. And I'm happy when on my journey from being a page to working in a production staff at SNL to making a documentary with Nagin Farsad, The Muslims Are Coming, to doing full-time comedy and now hosting a full-time radio show that's political for the last 4 years. It's been a journey. But I really go by that you should be doing things that you enjoy because you'll be better at them. It's not like it's not work. Believe me, it's work. I have to prep a lot for the show, but I feel like I'm doing something that makes a difference. And I think that changes the way your approach is to things. So I really hope people do the YOLO thing. You do only live once. Take a chance. If you don't have kids, it's even easier. I mean, so.
Talk about a terrible panel for the topic, because all three of us basically fucking went out on a limb and continue to do so in our lives. Yes. So we're going to like not have the best take on this. Alice, again, guys, I just the things are in the news and then the panels have been pre-scheduled. I apologize. Allison, have you seen this in action with your more like buttoned up friends?
I think a little bit. I don't know that I have a ton of buttoned up friends with like full-time like corporate jobs left. Everybody's kind of a comedian, right, and a TV writer. But I do think there is something to, like, you know, Dean said, like, if you don't have kids, and it's like, I think a lot of the people we're talking about are millennials. Like, that's like what the crux of a lot of this like trend piece has been, which is like millennials are leaving their jobs. And it's like, yeah, they don't have kids or mortgages because those things are literally not even options for them. So like, of course, it's easier to be like, I'm going to go try this for a year. I'm going to go do this thing. Like, there is nothing tethering anybody to that world except for kind of enslavement to, like, capitalism. And no one likes that. That's bad. Like, I just think that, like, I think the pandemic has also shown, like, everything goes away in a minute. And it's not even like, you know, you only live once, do this while you can. It's like, nothing that was promised to me is actually here. Nobody's companies stepped in and was like, how do we protect you? How do we make, there is, I think that this revealed something I remember my dad telling me forever, where he's like, no one cares about you. Like, that was like, not like people, but he was like,
what a heartwarming message.
He's like, literally you, no one cares about you. But he was like, your job doesn't care about you. You are not like, that is not what the world is, especially anymore. And so, like, and I think that a lot of people learned that this year, and who were like, I'm going to dedicate the next 10 years to this law firm, this whatever. And we're seeing, like, that there was no reciprocal, like, we will protect you, we will take care of you, that, like, I think a lot of people buy into when they take jobs that are demanding. And I think it also just was like, well, if they're not here for me, then I'm not going to be here for them. Fuck this. Oh, sorry. Are we allowed to swear? I forget. I apologize.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. I mean, the funny... Okay, so part of... like, I totally hear what you're saying, and I bet you that does apply to a lot of people. But the other thing that I think is happening is that these people are not... they don't actually care about being enslaved to capitalism. They're, like, leaving this job so they could be enslaved to capitalism in a different way.
Yes, absolutely. You know
what I mean? Like, these are, like... a lot of these people are, like, going to start do startups. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They're full, like, they're just... they just want to be maybe more entrepreneurial on a solo front. By the way, a Microsoft survey found that more than 40% of workers globally were considering leaving their jobs this year. So just if, you know, we want to see some tech workers, among tech workers, that's 49% of people found that they wanted to get a new job. Part of what I think we're seeing is people in their 20s. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think we're seeing a phenomenon, except for that we're seeing people in their 20s who are in these white collar jobs, who are disproportionately represented by journalists. You know what I mean? Whose stories are disproportionately covered by journalists because they have journalist friends. You know what I mean? Because they all went to the same, you know, fancy school. And I went to those schools too. And we're all just getting the fucking story of, like, oh my God, my friend left and she has a startup idea and she's just like YOLO. You know what I mean? And, like, yeah, because that's the fucking cohort that you're in, you know? So part of, and also, yeah, like, if you're in your 20, I mean, when I was in my 20s, I was at a job as a policy advisor, and this is kind of crazy. I was at a job as a policy advisor. I asked for a sabbatical. I truly had no business. I had gone to grad school, blah blah blah. I'm working for the city, and I asked my boss, I want a sabbatical because I'm going to go to India, make a movie for 2 months. They were like, sure. And they, like, let me do it. Wow. By the way, bless the city of New York in this one moment for letting me do that, because then I came back, I worked for another several months, but then I ultimately left that job. But, you know, and went to become a full-time comedian. That's, like, I think just what you do in your 20s. You take big risks, you make big swings, you just do crazy things, you ask for crazy things. I mean, part of it is we're just talking about a bunch of 20-year-olds who also experienced a pandemic and they're feeling itchy in their body. They just want to get out, you know? And the other thing I think, so a lot of these companies that there's in that article that I shared, they talked about, like, Credit Suisse is, like, offering fully paid, all expenses paid vacations. And, like, you know, one of these companies, I think it was LinkedIn or Twitter, is, like, giving one more day off a month. And it's, like, your rest day. And, like, there's all these little things that companies are doing so that people can recharge. And there is burnout because everyone hates being on Zoom. Everyone hates being in their own kitchen, you know, working all day long. It just sucks. So I think, yeah, you need to offer more stuff. You need to do all of that. Also, you guys are really rich companies to begin with. So why haven't you been offering that stuff from the very fucking beginning? But I also think a big thing that exists a lot in academia that doesn't exist in a lot of these for-profit organizations is the idea of sabbaticals. People yeah. should have, there should be a lot. It should not be a weird thing to take a mid-career sabbatical. Just go, get out for a couple of months, go do a pottery class or whatever it yeah. is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and do that thing. You know what I mean? And then come back and then you're refreshed. I think part of the problem we're seeing that maybe the French aren't seeing is like, we just don't have enough vacation in American life. Yeah. And so it might lead to like some crazier decisions. What do you think?
I agree. I think that people take, if you work for a big company, they will take you for granted. Now, it really seems when you talk to younger people, and by the way, I'm only 28. Trump aged me. I just look like this because of what Trump did to me. But I think when you work in bigger companies now, people really get the sense there's no loyalty from the other side. It's simply a paycheck. And that there's no promise that you, if you're a lawyer, that you'll make partner. And if you make partner, there's no promise you'll actually be there for all your life like it was decade generations ago. Corporations can downsize tomorrow and you're gone. There's no sense if you work for a big company that you're anything more than a fungible good. Even if they like you today, tomorrow, or if they slash the budget and you're gone, everyone knows it. So perhaps it makes people want to do other things with their lives that they would not have done, that if there was stability, if there truly was a path to like, hey, this is really going to work out and I can have fun on the other end and have more vacation. But I do agree 100%, Nikki. There should be more vacation. People should use their vacation. I know countless people who get 3 weeks or 4 weeks and don't use it on their own. They've made it, I can't.
That's just crazy.
And they feel pressure from their bosses or even subtle pressure of, if I go away, what's going to happen? Because they're afraid of losing their job or not getting the bonus, whatever it is. So even those places that are giving some really good benefits, some people don't take advantage of a sabbatical because they feel like they're going to lose their place on that ladder upwards.
Now it's funny because I feel like my position is almost like, don't take a risk on yourself and do something you love. Like, take vacation. It's almost what it sounds like I'm saying. I mean, because I do think if you are like staring down the barrel of like a comedy career, but you have like a cushy job, that here's what I think. Your worth shouldn't be tied up in your job. Right. And I think that's, again, like, not to reference the French again, but it's just that I've lived there, you see. And so I have a little bit of experience with the French mentality. And the French never talk about what they do because it's like their entire identity isn't mixed up in what you do. I think this idea that like what you do is your value and you should love it and love what you do and all that stuff. It's very like American, like loving what you do is almost ridiculous in some other cultures. And I'm not saying like that you shouldn't love what you, obviously, whatever, obviously, but I'm just saying like, what if your job isn't your fundamental thing? You know, mm-hmm. What if it is a vehicle to allow you to have money so you get to go to Santa Fe and do pottery classes sometimes?
You really want to go to Santa Fe?
I cannot stop talking about Santa Fe. But you know what I mean? Like, what if like your identity isn't your job? You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's okay. And in America, we don't talk like that. Mm-mm. And I would love to talk like that. I would love to be in a world where I don't. And I've done this so many times where I go, I'm at a party or whatever, and my first question is, what do you do?
Yeah.
Like, who fucking cares who gives you your 1099? You know what I mean? Like, what? All right, so folks, let us know what you think of the YOLO economy. Are you YOLOing your own personal economy? Do you think it's a dumb term? Hit me up, let me know what you think. But in the meantime, let's take a quick break and hear about our sponsors. These sponsors we love because they keep the lights on here at Fake the Nation. And when we come back, we'll talk about other things. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back. And we are ready for topic number two. So remember Bernie came out in 2016 and said we should talk about race maybe a little less. Well, that question is looming large, especially now, because there's a study that came out from Micah English and Joshua Kalla at Yale. And in that study, they said this is basically their thesis. Despite increasing awareness of racial inequities and greater use of progressive race framing by Democratic elites, linking public policies to race is detrimental for support of those policies. disease. Okay, so this is basically their finding in their study. And let's basically start with, and I want to just also point out, Dean is a Muslim dude, half Palestinian, half Sicilian Muslim dude. Allison, what are you?
Jewish, and then my dad's family is heavily Native American. So a lot of, I don't have any association or ties to a tribe or any upbringing like that, but it is part of my
of your background.
Heritage and something I think about a lot.
Okay. And as listeners know, I'm an Iranian American, Muslim, and none of us are black here. But we do represent some other things. And I still want to get our theories on what the Democratic Party should be doing. And I want to let listeners know that, like, we schedule panelists for weeks in advance. We do not peg the panelists to topics. And also, like, you know, I have this personal weird thing, which is, like, every time there's a terrorist attack or something, MSNBC calls, or, you know, one of the cable networks call me up, like, Nagin, what are your thoughts on terrorism? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I could actually talk about so many other things. Why don't we have me not talk about terrorism? And I said MSNBC, it actually happens with all the cable networks. And so I also love to hear people's opinions on anything under the sun that isn't their specific identity, because I also don't like pigeonholing people. The balance of the show is that we try and get a bunch of different voices, and I just happen to have glanced at the numbers. About 45% of our panelists are BIPOC, and around the same proportion are LGBTQ+. So I don't know. So I just wanted you all to know I think about these things constantly. That said, where do you think we are with race and class in the current narrative? Like, where are Democrats? Where were they in 2020 in the elections? Like, where do you think these narratives are playing out? How do you think they're playing out, Dean?
I think race is becoming a bigger divide now than politics. I think that the political divide is more of a racial divide. The GOP has really become Team White, and a white nationalist movement. That's really what's going on here. So, you know, there's very few policies I think you're going to get the white nationalists to come on board with us in terms of social justice or even raising the minimum wage. But, you know, Heather McGee has a great book, The Sum of Us, and it's actually in that article you sent. I interviewed Heather.
Yeah, yeah.
Heather, about the zero-sum mentality of conservative white people, that if minorities get any benefit whatsoever, in their view, they're taking away from them. So it has to go always back to the zero. So plus one for African Americans is minus one in their view. But that's getting worse now. So I'm not really in any way optimistic that we're going to be able to build multiracial coalitions with people on the right. I think people in the middle, people on the left. I think for some people, you make it about race and racial justice. For others, people in the middle, you could make it about class or an economic message. Like Heather McGee in her book, it's really about, hey, we're all in this together. If you raise minimum wage, it helps everyone. Helps white people a lot, helps black people, brown people, everyone. So I think it depends on the audience you're talking to, but I don't think Democrats for a second should back off fighting for racial justice, fighting and being open about that, because if Democrats are not fighting for people of color, there's no party fighting for people of color. You're on your own. And I would hate to be,
right.
I would not be a Democrat anymore if they were not fighting for communities like ours, African American, Hispanic, and other communities.
And Heather McGee, actually, I think the one main kind of starting example in her book that was really, which I've only read excerpts, I haven't read the full book, it's on my list. But in the excerpt I read, you know, she talks about she uses the metaphor of the drained pool, right? In the 60s, after segregation was overthrown, it became clear that pools were going to become desegregated, right? And what white people did in the 60s, yeah, instead of having pools become desegregated where they would have to share water with black people, they just drained the pools so nobody had a pool, right? And so as a result, a ton of white people, like, just also didn't grow up with pools that their previous generation had grown up with, which is so crazy to me. They were so upset about desegregation. They were just like, nobody gets to have the fun thing or the good thing. The same thing happened with Truman in the 1940s. He wanted to create a national health insurance. in the 40s, right? And they meant that that meant, and it, you know, the Southern racists kind of predicted that that would mean integrating hospitals. So they were against it. So it meant that white people didn't get this health insurance. And as a result, here we are now generations later, and there's those same white people still don't have health insurance, right? Or they're able to get it on the Obama exchange, or they're in a state where they didn't allow the expansion of Medicare, you know what I mean? So it's like they still don't have health insurance. So this is all just because, and it's so it's weird. The racism actually helps, like stopped the awesome thing happening for white people, which is kind of the fantastic thing that Heather McGee points out in The Sum of Us. Allison, where do you think we're at with how we talk about race in the Democratic Party?
I mean, it's hard because like also when I was reading that article from the New York Times that you sent us, I was like, oh, I don't know how to read a study anymore because my brain has been destroyed by the internet. And I was like, can someone sum this up in one sentence? like, what's a tweet that would summarize this whole extensive, important, thorough research article?
Right.
I do think, like, talking about, like, you know, how white people would rather, like, lose something than share it with black people. I think somebody tweeted this, and I wish I could credit the source, but in talking about television writing jobs, which of course now we're talking about like the height of luxury and not basic human care for
right,
people.
Right, right.
But like sure. That often the trend with when you talk about diversity and when you talk about, you know, expanding the voices in a room is that the straight white men who are now excluded feel like they point to the one woman, the one LGBT, the one person of color in that room and say,
right,
this person took my job. And it's like, no. One of the other seven white guys on this staff took your job. This is not somebody who, like, I feel like that's the same sentiment that kind of, like, permeates how we talk about race, just, like, from the parties and from, like, larger political or, like, policy points of view or whatever. So I do think that, I do think that the Democratic Party needs to continue to talk about race. It is so incredibly important and enmeshed in almost everything that happens in this country. Unfortunately, we have to do a ton of deprogramming for so many people to explain that giving people who are not white things does not take them away from white people. It helps everyone.
So, like, what about the argument? So, it's funny because Matt Iglesias in his newsletter, Slow Boring, basically said something like anti-racist messaging is a net loser in terms of votes, which is basically the tweet that summarizes
yes,
the study.
Yes,
right?
Yes, that's what I like gleaned.
And, right. So, like, what if it's about winning? I mean, do we just want to win with using class-based arguments? So we're like, hey, everybody gets health insurance, and it doesn't, you know, and it's like the silent part is that includes, you know, people of color. Yeah. But like, we don't say that part, and we're just like, everybody gets it, hey guys, everybody. So we emphasize class, but then it means winning. And this is like, I feel like it is, look, it's a Sophie's Choice situation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard for, and also the three, you know, I can see a strategist being like, look, I'm going to write this speech as if everything is just about poor people getting more stuff, middle class people getting more stuff, life being less difficult, and just talk about it in terms of class because that's what's going to win people over. And the numbers, you know, of the studies sort of like do kind of show that even Republicans are more likely to join, get on board with something if it's framed as a class issue and not a race issue. Is winning, like, I guess how mad would you be if the Democratic Party was like, in order to win, we're going to take this strategy? Just as a hypothetical, again, I'm not saying that you want this yourselves, but like, how mad would you be, Dean?
I would say we don't win because if you're not speaking to the black community's needs, which they voted over 90% for Joe Biden and Democrats, and specifically to the needs of the Hispanic community, Latino community, which voted like 60%+, then you're ignoring them. And why are they going to turn out? Because they're going to feel ignored. It's a conversation I have with listeners on my show all the time. This idea of identity politics being inherently bad, it's not. It's talking about the concerns of a community that are unique to the community and showing you care about them, you understand them, you've talked to them, you get to know them. This is what's important to me. You can't win Eve, you're going to whitewash and do colorblind messages for our side. For the other side, maybe you can. But again, look, the beauty of today's world is you can tailor messages on Facebook if you're trying to reach moderate white people, make it geo-specific to where Whitey lives. I think overall, if someone is going to be so upset because you're talking about Black Lives Matter, which the Republican Party now views as a symbol of hate, they even view the 1619 Project. The big thing now is 1619 yeah. Project is evil. And in Idaho this week, they literally passed a law. Schools cannot use funding to teach kids about critical race theory, which is systemic racism. You can't teach it. So, and that's a state that's 93% white and less than 1% black. But white fragility is so acute in that state that 93% of white people are like, we can't have talking about black people in our school. So you're never going to reach them. I'm being honest. I'm at a different point in my life. I'm an old man now. No, there are certain people you can build. I think it's more about inciting your base and getting them excited to come out to vote. That's how you win. Not reaching beyond your borders to people who are on the right, not even far right. And some in the middle, you can tailor a message for them specifically.
Okay, but Biden, when he's going out there trying to sell the American Families Plan or whatever, can't necessarily be that targeted, right? When he's making big speeches, it's like he's just making big speeches. Is there something about...
But yesterday, just playing the game, like yesterday, yeah. President Biden spoke about COVID vaccine, and he said, we brought down deaths among senior citizens by 80%. Then he goes, among African-Americans, 70%. Among Hispanics, 80%. That's the kind of thing where you're talking the big picture. You're not saying, I don't care about white people. That's not the message at all. But you're saying, right. I also care about your community specifically. That's why I'm mentioning it. That's why when Joe Biden's speech last week talked about transgender community and telling them, I have your back, that was one line in his speech, but it meant a lot. To transgender sure, yeah. teens who are under the gun by the right, who are demonizing them horrifically right now.
Who've probably literally never heard any word of support from an office of that level ever. I guess, Allison, what do you think about losing?
I mean, we're Democrats. We're used to it. Unfortunately, I will say
I'm so like torn about this because I'm like, I want us to win so that we could put in all of the policies that then actually correct.
Right.
You know, the racism. You know? Yes. But so part of me is like, let's win, you know? And then part of me is like, if we have to win and be like real shitbags, that sucks. You know, it would be really hard for me personally, like, you know, not to talk about race.
Yeah.
Just in my own discourse, you know, I could. So where do you think? What do you think about losing?
I mean, I do think like the ultimate goal is to win as much as possible and therefore enact the policies that we're talking about right now that actually protect everyone that's living in this country and not just, you know, fragile white people who don't understand how to talk about race. But at the same time, I mean, I think about specifically when you talk about like the police murdering black people and police brutality in general. That, of course, has to become a race issue because it's so clearly right. happening to Black Americans. But you can't be
right.
very transparently talking about race with that and then go into discussions about economic policy and blanket over the fact that those two things are absolutely enmeshed. And you have to kind of bring up that police brutality is not separate from the fact that we need universal childcare and we need a universal income and we need universal healthcare for people and protecting community. So like, and like proper housing and like fair community resources. So like, you can't like talk about those as like this like broad non-racial issue and then talk about something as specific as maybe police brutality or there are dozens of other examples. And make that so clearly about race, which it is, because I feel like then that's a disparity that's like hard to wrap your head around. But again, like, how do you do both and still win seats and still win votes and still like be able right. to enact the policies that actually do help? Like, that's the tricky thing. And that's why I'm in comedy and not politics. I'm like, I can figure out a punchline. I don't know how we solve this mess.
Well, you know, it also just like reminds me of, you know, MLK at the time of his death was like far more preaching and even throughout his life preached these kind of like socialist policies.
Yeah.
Right. As as corrections to like all sorts of social ills beyond race, yeah. you know? And it's interesting because it seemed like almost that when it seemed possible for him to be, to kind of transcend race in that way is when he became even more dangerous right. and was, you know, as we know, taken out. And so, so I think, but it's also like, you know, it's also part of that is being the kind of messenger that he was specifically. Mm-hmm. I think actually part of me feels like Bernie sort of did a decent job in 2020 of just saying like class-based, and this is how class-based will affect, and then like subcategory, this is how these class-based policies will affect like, you know, our racial concerns, mm-hmm. our race inequity concerns, you know, and it felt kind of like he had sort of figured that out a little bit.
Yeah.
And a part of it is just like headline. Also, though, you know, or something. Mm-hmm. And I might be diminishing Bernie or whatever. But I think there's ways of doing it that are just, you know, like a lot of this is just like speech writing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of like elegantly organizing a speech. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not trying to diminish all the fucking these issues into just it's speech right. writing, but what we're talking about mm-hmm. is messaging specifically. Oh my God, I am just envisioning the angry emails I'm getting. So anyways, but you know what? Forget everything I've said in the last 10 minutes. any closing thoughts on this, Dean?
No, I think that Bernie, he did make it all about class and fighting for the working class and lower class people. And he didn't talk about race specifically, but he did work really hard to build relations with the Hispanic community, specifically like Nevada and other places, and with the right, black right. community, but it really worked. So look, he even tailored his message specifically to reach each community. That's what you're doing. You're a politician. You want to show people you care about them, you understand their concerns, and you reach out to them accordingly. So there's nothing wrong with having a targeted message. And, you know, as Allison is saying, though, on certain issues, if you don't talk about race, you're being intellectually dishonest. Everyone sees right through it.
Right.
Like on the right, I mean, everything, it's a few bad apples. Yeah. Well, apparently the bad apples have been everywhere now. The bad apple, like Tim Scott, the Republican senator, talked about being pulled over 7 times in a year, but denies systemic racism. So the 7 bad apples happened to catch him. That was it. They're all just that 7 bad apples caught him that year. Systemic racism right. is what Tim Scott has endured. So they're being intellectually dishonest. So on certain issues, you can. On other issues, you don't have to talk about race. If you're going to talk about minimum wage, talk about how it helps everyone. But then I think a good politician would say, and, you know, for the white, poor whites, this is how it's going to help. And for African-Americans or Latino community or Asian-American community, here's how it's going to help. But everyone hears what they want to hear. It's not specific to one community by mentioning all communities. Maybe that's the way, some kind of balance.
Right. Folks, let me know what you think. I think we've come down on, you can combine messages. Like, you can talk to people where they're at. Like, it should maybe we're over-intellectualizing it. You know, the guys at Yale? I don't know. Maybe not. Let me know what you think. I'm so curious. Whatever you think is safe. Like, I mean, unless it's real shitty.
I mean, I will say, right. Can I say one more final point quick?
Before yeah, say one more thing.
I hate to add to an ending, but also if we had more political leaders who were not straight white men, who were people of color and women, who are like saying, hey, here's something that's going to help all of us. And if that messaging, what's hard is it's always coming from 85-year-old white men being like, all right, let me make sure everybody likes this. But if we had more
diverse
voices being like, hey, this is going to help all of our communities, I do think that that would make the messaging easier to have to do, because you wouldn't have to be a white guy being
messaging.
Like, hey, black people, it's okay, this is a good thing for you, but hey, white people, don't worry, this will help you too. Like, if you had a black woman saying that, perhaps it, I mean, that has all of its other many caveats
totally.
For what doesn't work there, unfortunately, in this stupid country. But I do think that that would help eliminate a little bit of the problems that we're talking about.
No, that's an excellent point. It's much easier to make that for some mouths to make the message. Yes. Okay, folks, let me know what you think. And next topic. Okay, so a listener reached out to me, Douglas Torrey, on Twitter, and he basically wanted us to talk about, quote, the culpability of Hollywood in the epidemic of gun violence / police violence. So movies, he says, both capture and shape our imaginations, our views of what's possible, and so often the answer to whatever problems anchor the plotline is a hefty arsenal of pornographically photographed firearms, badass protagonist plus super slick gun plus witty quip equals problem solved. So I want to talk about violence in film and television and first ask, like, what's your relationship to violence on TV? Are you immune to it? Do you consume a lot of it? Like, Allison, where are you at? I mean, Marvelous Miss Maisel is not known as a very violent
show. Well, you haven't seen season 4 yet. No, I'm just kidding. Midge buys a gun. No, obviously not. But I mean, I am someone who is not super into watching violence. I don't watch any of even the superhero, the Marvel universe, all of that. Like, that's just not super appealing to me. I prefer a quiet like rom-com or like a goofy comedy. That's just my personal taste, and I fully understand and have loved. I mean, like, I loved Breaking Bad. It's a very violent show that really does glamorize guns. So, like, it's not that I don't watch any of it, but I am more drawn to things that are not violent.
They don't do that.
Like,
right.
Over, you know, as an overtone. Yeah.
Dean, where are you at with violence?
I love violence. I'm a big fan of violence. I watch, all I watch is violence. It's Breaking Bad, Homeland. It's sort of on a loop. I mean, and then I'll watch a Schitt's Creek episode for fun. But then I'm back to violence right after
back
that.
Back on the violence.
It's interesting. I don't like video games that are like Call of Duty. I played once for free, and you go out and actually shoot people in this blood. I'm like, this is awful. I actually found it despicable. But I like war movies a lot. And you know, there is violence that could be justifiable in a movie, but for some reason, like Saving Private Ryan and a lot of war movies, I'm drawn to. I don't know why. I have this sense that in another life, I served in a war. I'm not sure which side I was on. I don't know what I did in it. I might not have been on the U.S. side. I don't know, you know, but in any point, any event, but I don't have I don't like up close violence. But in video games, I'll play war video games, but not when you're shooting people, like you're shooting a plane down or a ship. Stuff like that. I like those games. I can't help it. I'm a child. I just don't like seeing people die. I don't like that part.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the weird thing that has happened, you know, in the last however many years is that like all of prestige drama surrounds like a murder. I think Breaking Bad is a little bit of a different kind of story because it's a sort of it's about entrepreneurship. but putting that kind of thing aside, I think a lot of the shows where, you know, I just started watching like Mayor of Easttown on HBO, and there's like, you know, it's a cop and there's a murder and she's got to figure it out, and she, you know, and there's other, you know, she's gonna hold a gun too. I mean, you know, I don't like, I hope I didn't give very much away, but there's, you know, it's like, and I'm watching this, I'm like, why am I always watching shit about someone got murdered? We're like extensively looking at this murdered body, you know? That's weird. I don't like seeing bullet holes in, you know, cadavers. Like, it just really, it feels like we, and then you look at like the top ranking shows are stuff like, you know, Law and Order SVU and the CSIs and the Chicago whatevers and the blah, blah, blah. All this world, I mean, it's this very extensive world of like murder-based and violence-based stuff that we sort of take in. I find, and I don't know if you guys have experienced this, I actually find it difficult to find comedy. Like there's much fewer, far fewer comedies on offer than there is murders. Like, you can find a murder to watch every night, but I don't know that you can find comedies to watch at that same pace.
No.
And there was actually a study between 2000 and 2018, and they found that violence on popular primetime dramas doubled from 2000 to 2018, increasing in parallel with a proportion of deaths by firearm in the U.S. So, you know, this came out of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, and the authors of the study said, look, we can't draw a causal conclusion, but that we do have a hypothesis that what happens in the media can be influential to what's happening in real life. In it, and they found the correlation to be strongest in 15 to 24-year-olds, but also and second strongest in 25 to 34-year-olds. So I think, like, I didn't very much think about the actual real world implications of it, just that it can't be great that we all love watching murder so much. Allison, what do you think?
Well, I think also, like, something, because, like, I think about this a lot just, you know, in making TV, but, like, the other thing that's been happening alongside violence in scripted TV and real life violence in this country is the rise of the docuseries, like the actual documentaries about murders. I mean, like, that has and the world of,
like,
true
making a murder,
the world of true crime has
things.
Exploded,
yeah.
And those are very compelling and very well done, and there are so many of them because there are so many murders that, like, I do think that entertainment television, like pure entertainment television, not based on documentary, has had to level up because, well, I'm watching, like, why would I watch a murder on SVU when I can watch this story about an actual murder that has higher stakes? Like, whether that's, like, good or bad, I can't even, like, begin to start to weigh in. But, like, objectively, those stakes are are much higher. And, like, TV has to now compete with real life murder.
Real life.
And I think that all of that is just kind of all reflecting itself back, kind of like a loop. And there aren't a lot of things, like you said, that aren't violent. There aren't a ton of comedies. When I look at what movies come out every year, it's like a few, like, award season, like, smaller films that are incredible that are not super violent, and then just superheroes and John Wick in every, you know, and that's, like, doesn't appeal to me. And I'm like, where are the rom-coms? Where are the, like, thrillers where no one dies? Where's all of that? Like, I feel like there used to be more kinds of movies, and there are not that many kinds of movies anymore. Big theater releases.
Yeah. And it's really frustrating. Dean, feel like it might, here's the other thing that I was to say is that it also makes it seem, now, while there are a bunch of murders, you know, in America and internationally, I'm not going to take other countries' murders away from them. While there are a bunch of murders, you're still statistically very unlikely to be murdered. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And yet, because of the preponderance of this media, like, people like my mom are like, well, I might get murdered. And I'm like, lady, why would you specifically get murdered? You know what I mean? And so I'm like, you're not going to get murdered. You know what I mean? And so what's happening, I think, is it's creating, even if it doesn't, you know, even if these numbers are just a correlation and not a causation, it's also creating this other thing of everyone just thinking about murder a lot more than they ever need to think about murder. You know what I mean? Dean, what do you think?
I've been thinking about murder a lot lately. And I don't know, I've just been sort of obsessed. Some would say planning. I thought it was interesting about that report that I was just happy to be reading this report, you know, by these authors that Nagin sent it to us. That's why I read it. And about the big jump in on TV of violence. And is there a causation and a causal link between that and upticks in violence in our society? You know, and of course, in Europe, they have the same shows we do. Essentially, you can get them online now. Some are on their TV or some are online. And they same video games, and they don't see the uptick. And I think the difference is access to guns in our country is just unbelievably too easy for people. You know, TV shows are not. Over 100 people are killed every day by guns. About 60 of them or so are by suicides. A little over 30 are murders. That's everyday existence in our society. It goes up or down slightly. And it's easy access to guns and a refusal to make it harder for people who shouldn't have guns having access to it. You know, sadly enough, the Republicans have made a choice. Easy access to guns are more important than a woman's life in many cases. Well, they vote against, like, closing the boyfriend loophole, making it hard for someone who's a stalker, who is a boyfriend, convicted of being a stalker from getting a gun. GOP have voted against it. This is what we live in. So I don't know how much TV inspires someone to go on a mass shooting spree, but seeing those images all the time can't be good.
A friend of mine was saying that he dated two women back to back who had to fall asleep to order to episodes of SVU. I think to whatever. Is there multiple SVUs? I've lost track. But anyways, and I was like, that can't be good. Like that it seeps into your mind. Like if you're falling asleep to just murder stories,
yeah,
like, that's weird.
Well, we need a break.
It can't be good for you. Right. So, okay. So, Allison, this question is for you from our listener. He says, how do you portray nonviolent conflict resolution as sexy? Like, how about de-escalation tactics? I'm tired of seeing supermodels in tight leather reaching for an AK-47 to get the job done. Let's imagine something different. So, Allison, as a TV writer, yes, can you see a world in which we're writing about policing and it's like the most fun to watch de-escalation tactics?
I mean, I thought...
Like, is it just a challenge of writing that, like, can you do... I mean, I feel like you could do it. You know what
maybe.
I mean?
Maybe. I feel like it's about telling different stories, because I think about this all the time, because I think about when Knocked Up came out and everybody was really upset, myself included, because they were like, this woman in real life would have just had an abortion. She would not have had that baby.
Right.
Why did you make a movie where she has the baby? She should have had the abortion. And the response is, of course, well, that movie would be 10 minutes long, or because it's Judd, it'd be like an hour long. But that's right. And so for that movie specifically, like, she was going to have that baby because that's the story he's telling. Now I feel like there are a few movies that are telling the story of a woman having an abortion, and that is its own different story separate. So I think, like, while we'll never make anything that's as sexy and glamorous as gun violence on TV, like, we're just not going to, like, it is objectively entertaining. It's like, well, how do we tell, like, why don't we tell other stories that are the other side of this? And like, why don't we, like, look for other paths that aren't, how do we just tell the same story, but like, instead of everybody getting shot, there's a mediator? Like, that's not the answer, but it's like, but what's a story we can tell that does talk about a mediator that is glamorous and interesting that might be different than the path we were on with gun violence?
Yeah,
there's so many stories.
There's sky's the limit, folks. Dick Wolf, hey, sky's
also
the limit.
More comedies.
I feel like there's so many stories. And
just
then also,
more comedies.
Let's just have more comedies. Just more comedy. What about like just far less focus on any kind of policing in our entertainment
enough
at all?
Enough of that.
All right, folks. Let me know what you think. Do you have any ideas? I'm here for them. And thank you so much to our listener for giving us that topic idea, folks. That's the end of the show. Oh my God, thank you so much for joining us. And what I would really love is for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you in all the wonderful stuff that you do. Allison, where do they do that?
You can follow me personally at Allison Leiby on Twitter and Instagram, but you can also follow my podcast, which I do with the very funny Hallie Kiefer, where she tells me what happens in every horror movie so I never have to see them because I'm too scared. Our podcast is called Ruined. You can listen to it everywhere that podcasts are available, and follow us at Ruined Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Request movies. We have fun. It's great.
That sounds awesome. Also, because I am that person who
can't
watch horror movies, and I would need someone else to explain it
to
me.
But I
want to
know what happens. Like, I just don't want to watch it.
Definitely follow Allison and all of her work. She's amazing. And I've been such an admirer of her for many years. Dean, where do people find you?
Well, on Twitter at Dean Obidala, or Instagram, the same thing, at Dean Obidala, or my website, deanofradio.com. I have a show 5 nights a week on SiriusXM channel 127 Progress from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And Nagin has been on. So if you have SiriusXM, I hope you'll check out my show, call in and be a part of it. Or you can email me at dean@deanofradio.com.
Oh my gosh, I've done many, 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 many shows with Dean. It's always fun. It's always, there's some insightful, but then funny, but then insightful again. So definitely check out his show. And folks, again, I'm going to be posting about some show that I will be doing probably June 8th. So please look out for that. Let me know how you feel about showing your vaccination status if I do a show. I would love to know if that's cool with you. And what I would really love to do is thank the people that make this show possible. That's our producer, Julia Linden, our sound engineer, Stephanie Aguilar, and our wonderful people at HeadGum. The theme music is by Gabby Alter. And as always, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Email us at fakethenation@headgum.com for ideas. ideas about topics like the one that Douglas shared with us today, guest ideas you might have, and again, join the Patreon for bonus content at patreon.com/NagineFarsad, and we'll be back in your earballs next week. Thank you!
That was a HeadGum Podcast.